On This Week in Enterprise Tech, the Secure Data Act is trying to prevent crypto backdoors. Google has some scary good conversational AI. And we talk with VMware's new acquisition, VeloCloud, who's reinventing the wide area network. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 290, recorded May 11th, 2018, The Race for WAN Leadership. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca. I'm going to take you through on a trip to the enterprise world, but who likes to take trips on their own, right?
This is how TWiT grows up, folks, because the young blood takes over and the old guys go out to pasture. So I'm going to go pasture myself. Wait, that doesn't sound right. No, that doesn't sound right.
That's okay. We'll figure that out. We'll figure that out. But of course, we don't want to go on this journey without it's not complete without Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. How are you, my friend? How's the state of Florida treating you?
Well, the state of Florida is nice. It's good to be here for a change. Back in the temporary studio as we continue renovations on what will be the Sunshine Studio. It's just great to be here, great to be on TWiT, and great to be someplace that doesn't involve air travel.
I'm with you on that. Well, guys, thanks for being here. We have a pretty great show. We talk a little bit about the Secure Data Act, how it's going to prevent crypto backdoors. Also, Google potentially talking about Google conversational AI. And of course, my favorite part of the show, we bring in a guest and we talk about VMware and how it's reinventing wide area networks. But first, of course, we have to get into the blips. So remember last September, that little credit agency Equifax, they started telling the world how it exposed data of millions of customers. That was a shocking number. And in fact, it matched half the population of the United States. People were really worried. But because the data was not only leaking just their social security numbers and addresses, but people thought that it was leaking their passport information as well, which could actually lead to falsified international documents. But this past February, Equifax put that to rest. They assured the public that the stolen data did not include passport numbers, or did it? In regulatory findings, Equifax slipped in some details that more than 56,000 documents had been compromised in the breach, including passports. In February, their spokesperson was quoted in saying, "Passport numbers were an element we examined while conducting the forensic investigation of the breach, but we found no evidence that any passport numbers were stolen." Well, it sounds like it might be a time for Equifax to get a new forensics crew. Is it me or Equifax is really slow on rolling out the truth? Because Equifax found out about the breach in July of 2017. It waited 6 weeks before announcing it publicly. In the meantime, the three of its executives sold about $2 million worth of their shares in the company. Now, almost 8 months later, they're also doing a double take on the data that was actually leaked. With 240 class action suits actively against Equifax, I have a feeling we haven't heard the last of them. One hopes legislation will catch up to the debacle soon, as big data is becoming the number one topic about privacy.
Now, we've talked about it on TWiT. It's been a good idea for years, and now it's here. Banning removable storage from the enterprise. Now, in this day and age, the TWiT crew has often talked about the ridiculous security hole that is the USB port. We recommended disabling them, removing them, even hot gluing your way into a more secure networking environment. But finally, a big enterprise player has made the move. Yesterday, IBM's Global Chief Information Security Officer, Shyamala Naidu, announced that the company will be prohibiting the use of all removable storage devices within their network. This includes USB drives, SD cards, and any other removable memory device that could be used to remove sensitive information from the network or to deliver payloads to client devices. Now, while this was, from an IT perspective, inevitable, in fact, it's already been implemented in many companies around the world, it will be interesting to see how IBM deals with specific use cases that are actually advocated by the company. For example, right now, the IBM tutorial on installing Linux on Power9 servers uses a USB flash drive, or migrating patching from memory devices to IBM's Sync and Share service. Still, good job, Big Blue. We'll be watching.
Treasure Hunter POS malware is out in the open, and that makes it, well, even more dangerous. The author of Treasure Hunter, a point-of-sale malware family that's been circulating in the wild since at least 2014, has released source code for the malware, but it's not just core functions that have been released. The threat actor has also released code for Treasure Hunter's graphical user interface builder and the malware's administrator panel, security vendor Flashpoint told us in an advisory this week. The code was released in a leading Russian underground forum, and in addition to the bad news, it has given security researchers fresh insight into the malware, which up to this point they've had to reverse engineer if they wanted to analyze. Flashpoint says its researchers have already observed Russian-speaking threat actors discussing ways to improve and weaponize Treasure Hunter in new ways. How exactly malware authors will use the code to improve Treasure Hunter remains unclear, but why release it now? It may be that things were getting just a little too hot for the original developer. Often, threat actors resort to releasing their code in an attempt to frustrate efforts by law enforcement investigators and security researchers to attribute attacks and malware to specific threat actors and groups. Way to go on the confusion.
So reality is about to set in after all the discussions and all the rigmarole. Net neutrality's demise has a date now. June 11th. Back in December, we heard about the FCC's plan to repeal the open internet rules set in 2015. If you haven't heard already, these rules were in place to assist consumers to have equal access to web content and bar broadband service providers from favoring their own material or others. FCC does have revised rules, but they're limited to requiring internet providers to tell consumers whether they will block or slow content or offer paid fast lanes. In response, Comcast Corp, Verizon, and AT&T have all pledged to not block or discriminate against legal content after the net neutrality rules expire. I guess seeing is believing here. Now, the new rules do go to the Senate late next week, and they can accept or deny them. In response to all this, a number of states have already adopted laws and aimed at dissuading internet providers from abandoning those net neutrality laws. Although the end seems near, the discussion is far from over.
Oh, back in 2015, Apple announced plans to build a mammoth $1 billion data center in Ireland that would take advantage of green energy, cheap cooling, and an abundance of land. Now, at the time, it seemed a magical deal for the portal to the land of Tir na n Og, which has a high dependence on foreign investment. However, the plan ran into several legal roadblocks from the owners of a nearby golf course over environmental impact. One suit led to another, then to an appeal, then an appeal of an appeal, and finally, the Supreme Court. But something strange happened over the course of Apple's legal woes. As the deal aged, support waned. As details of other data center deals started to become commonplace, suddenly that $1 billion deal didn't seem as attractive. On the pro side was $1 billion of construction and equipment purchase, but on the con side, exorbitant power demands, next to no hiring for such a large campus, and low continuing capital expenditures. As citizens and government officials mulled over the cons and looked at the tax incentives that were being demanded by Apple, they had second thoughts, and yesterday Apple scratched the entire project. Still, this is a great lesson for the enterprise. Many of our big players have counted on the desirability of large facilities with blockbuster initial expenditures, but now municipalities are getting wise about data centers with long-term demands and short-term gains. Expect more governments and municipalities to give more scrutiny to what these companies want for what is essentially an automated data factory. This could make the market far more interesting in the coming years.
Phishing is on the move to your mobile device. According to a new report, a mobile user is 18 times more likely to be exposed to a phishing attempt than to malware. While employees have been taught to be suspicious of links and attachments in email, there's considerably less scrutiny of channels like SMS, Skype, WhatsApp, games, and social media for the techniques and technologies that, well, try to get a user to be an accomplice in their own victimization. The risk is considerable, According to Wandera's mobile phishing report, the average iOS user has 14 different accounts on their work phone, typically including services such as Amazon, PayPal, and Airbnb. On Android, that number jumps to 20 unique apps. And both messaging and social media apps increased in popularity as an attack vector by more than 100% in 2017, with no sign of that growth slowing in 2018. As Mike Murray, Vice President of Security Intelligence at Lookout, said in an Interop ITX session, mobile has become not just a target, but the primary target in the enterprise.
So this Thursday, Washington, D.C. brought together industry reps for a summit to focus on AI and policy around it. This included representatives from Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, and more than 100 researchers, government officials, industry executives met to discuss what they're doing in the fields of artificial intelligence, robotics, and automation. The guest list also included representatives from Boeing, MasterCard, Ford, Land O'Lakes, and United Airlines. It was reported that Amazon's representative was Rohit Prasad, vice president and head scientist for the Alexa AI program. The topics of concerns included at the top of the list, privacy being number one, but have also included international competitiveness in AI research, since other countries around the world are doubling down on AI research. Other topics also included concerns about regulatory requirements for AI. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin stirred the pot a bit when he downplayed the potential impact of AI. He was quoted in saying that it would be 50 or 100 more years before the U.S. had to worry about the impact of automation on jobs. I think Google's recent debut of their Duplex is proof of concept, showing how AI can represent people when creating appointments in a scary human-like way. This proves that even the most tedious of tasks can be automated even today. Skynet might not be here yet, but the age of AI is. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up is the bites, and we have some pretty good ones. But first, we have to take a moment to thank our sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, which is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, this company is really truly trying to solve a big problem for buyers and sellers today. They are America's largest mortgage lender. J.D. Power even rated Quicken Loans the highest in customer satisfaction this past year. They were even ranked the highest in mortgage origination satisfaction for 8 years in a row. What Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage realized is it isn't easy to do refis, financing, or even starting a new loan. The process is really kind of behind the times, way behind the times. For me, it took over a pound of papers. A staple couldn't even go through the papers. Hours of my time, I had to go search for everything that I needed. I had to go find all the data in all my boxes in my file cabinets. It took a ton of time. And in fact, I was always asked, I was assigned a rep from the bank. They kept calling me, asking me for more data. I had to search for more things. I couldn't even email them the data. I had to fax it to them. Plus, I could never reach them. It was just super stressful. And that's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. They make it super simple. They reinvented the process so you don't have to waste your time. You don't have to stress about it. You get to go buy the house of your dreams with all that red tape in the way. You don't have to go to the bank. You can even do it on any device that has a browser from anywhere. All you have to do is go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. You spend a couple of minutes. You barely answer any questions. They basically ask you questions about things you already know, like, for instance, like what your name is, your address, the type of loan that you want, purchase price, the rate, a couple more things here and there. It's not things you actually have to search for, and that's it. Because Quicken Loans has partnerships with all the big financial institutions, they do the rest for you. That's all. They go get all the information they need to provide you with the right loan. You choose the rate, the term, and they show you the loans that you're actually qualified for, and it's all in just a couple minutes. Nowadays, the housing market is really kind of going crazy, especially here in Seattle. It's crazy here. And sometimes you have to put an offer in on the house at a moment's notice. You could be at an open house and they ask you for a pre-approval, or maybe they even ask you for a proof of loan. Well, now you could just jump on your phone right at the open house, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise, and all you have to do is show the seller's realtor that you're serious about buying that property. It's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. We thank Rocket Mortgage for making This Week in Enterprise Tech possible. Well, folks, let's go ahead and jump into the bites, and we have a pretty good doozy here. There's been a kind of a never-ending debate over giving law enforcement access to encrypted devices. Remember that argument that law enforcement gives? They say that, hey, as a part of a criminal investigation, there are thousands of devices that we just can't unlock. We can't get the data out of there. And so far, the government hasn't been able to force manufacturers like Apple to actually unlock or decrypt the phones and the devices for their data. So on Twyant in the past, we actually talked about how there was a third-party vendor called Grayshift. They were actually helping law enforcement agencies by giving them a $15,000 tool that actually unlocked 300 phones, or a $30,000 tool that had unlimited online access, which it basically allows you to continually unlock iOS 11 devices or anything before. We've also heard several other proposals from people like Ray Ozzie, who proposed that the phone's encryption key could actually be encrypted by a key known to the phone's manufacturer and then actually stored on the device. And if law enforcement's actually wanted to open the phone, it could basically use a search warrant, get the phone, actually extract that key, and then give it to the manufacturer, which then unwraps it, gives them the encryption key so they can actually unlock or decrypt the phone's data. Now, to me, the Ray Ozzie's proposal included, it basically targets the phone itself. And so if you do unlock it for one time, it could brick itself, preventing it from changing. But the EFF was not impressed. It was warned about many attempts to debunk the need for to basically get rid of encryption. So late last week, the EFF finally got fed up, and they marched some true security experts into the Capitol and to debrief the Senate in encryption. And essentially, it's the people like Dr. Matt Blaze, professor of computer science at the University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Susan Landau, professor of cybersecurity, Eric Neusenwander, Apple's manager of user privacy, and ESF's tech policy director, Dr. Jeremy Gillum. So what is the skinny of it? Well, with backdoors, you can weaken every computer security that protects our country. So they want to talk about like what it means to have responsible encryption, and they don't think it's going to cut it. So what does EFF support here? Well, it's called the Secure Data Act. Introduced by representatives from the Democratic and Republican parties, there is a bill. And the bill details, we don't want to go every line here, but we'll talk a little bit about it. It's a two-page bill, has some safeguards that uphold security both for developers and users. As the bill says, and I quote, "No agency may mandate a request that a manufacturer, developer, or a seller of covered products design or altered the security functions in the product or service to allow surveillance of any user of such product or service, or to allow the physical search of such product by any agency." So this bill essentially will protect companies that make encrypted mobile devices like phones, tablets, desktops, laptops, as well as developers of popular software for sending end-to-end encrypted messages, including Signal and WhatsApp, from being forced to alter their products in the way that they weaken their encryption. The bill also forbids the government from seeking a court order that would mandate such alterations. The lone exception is for wiretapping standards required under the 1994 Communications Law Enforcement Act, which itself specifically permits providers to offer end-to-end encryption of their services. Okay, so let's talk a little about this. I'm going to throw this over to Padre first. I think I want to understand, like, a lot of people talk about what responsible encryption is. Is there such a thing as responsible encryption?
Yeah, and that's what Ray Ozzie was trying to propose here. He was essentially giving us PGP for phones. The idea was you generated a key pair. You need both of them. One is stored on the phone that law enforcement could access. The other one, which was super secure, stored away in Apple, Samsung, Google's vault, was the private key. And you needed the private key in order to generate a complementary key that would unlock the device. Now, that had a lot of holes for a lot of different reasons, mostly dealing with the fact that it still boils down to trust. You have to trust someone that maybe you wouldn't otherwise trust. That might be Apple, that might be whatever agency is currently holding that super private key. Now, when we talk about responsible encryption, it's not just about trust. That's the major part of it. But it's also about the math. And this is the part that legislators have not been getting. You can't just mandate that there's a way to get into encryption without fundamentally destroying that encryption. You can't have a backdoor that only the good guys can access. That doesn't exist. That is a myth. They say it all the time. The FBI, in every push they have made to find a way into these devices, which they call them going dark, they have advocated a schema in which, well, just trust us. Well, we don't. We don't trust them anymore. So the only responsible encryption is the encryption that no one can get into unless you have the key, the one key, the key that belongs to the user. Now, we can discuss whether or not we should make a system in which law enforcement can petition to get that. But ultimately, that's not an encryption issue. That's a political issue.
Right, right. So I want to throw this over to Curtis. I think we talk about a little bit from the enterprise perspective. So the Secure Data Act basically says, listen, you manufacture hardware, you develop software that encrypts things. You're not allowed to give out the encryption key for that. Like, that's it. Once it's encrypted, it's there. Like, for instance, there's some services online like Mega Uploads and all these other services that encrypt things. They don't produce the encryption key. They don't decrypt. Will this help the enterprise in some way? Will this make sure that if I provide a service like this, customers can trust me a little bit more?
I don't know that it helps the enterprise much at all, because let's face it, most enterprises aren't in the business of providing encrypted data as a service. Where most enterprises do get involved is protecting the data that they keep on customers and prospective customers and keep it safe and secure. It's the sort of thing that enterprises like Equifax have shown that they're not terribly good at, in the same way that the government has shown that it's not terribly good at keeping its own secrets. And I could give you a whole long list of examples of why that's so. As Padre said, this is all about trust. And I think when it comes to most enterprises and the public, the trust is maximized when the public feels that there is a more or less unbreakable encryption scheme at work. And just to give you an example of how important it is, a couple of months ago, I had a chance to interview Michael Chertoff, who, if you'll recall, was the first Secretary of Homeland Security. I asked him about strong encryption, encryption that could not be broken by law enforcement. He's in favor of it. He feels that the economic and political advantages of strong encryption outweigh any theoretical advantage that comes from giving law enforcement a backdoor.
Makes sense. So this bill is actually not too long. It's only two pages, but the wording is kind of interesting. And Padre, you had a quick comment about that.
Yeah, so when you look at the actual wording of the law, the action takes place in subsection B. So this is the actual wording when it deals with court orders. So a court, after a law enforcement agency has approached it and said, well, we would like this, they are, let me quote this, except as provided in subsection C, no court may issue an order to compel a manufacturer, developer, or seller of covered products to design or alter the security functions in its products or services to allow the surveillance of any user of such product or service, or to allow the physical search of such products by an agency. That's pretty unambiguous. It's basically saying, look, there is in no way, shape, or form can a law enforcement agency approach a company and say, we would like you to weaken the encryption, or, as we had in the case with Apple versus the FBI, come in after the fact and say, we want you to break the encryption that you created. However, subsection C is the exceptions. And this is where it gets kind of tricky. It says, subsection A and B, that's what we just talked about, apply to mandates, requests, or court orders shall not apply to mandates, requests, or court orders authorized under the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act. So that is the loophole. So if you can go through that section, it means that the court now has the ability to let law enforcement do those things that I just said they couldn't do. And then we get back to the same problem, which is, but if we've built unbreakable encryption, they can't do that. You can't just mandate that the encryption is broken if you've constructed it to be unbreakable. So, you know, yes, I like the wording of this law. Yes, I like the spirit of the law. Yes, I think the bill is actually a step forward. It shows that there's more knowledge and understanding of how encryption works among our lawmakers. However, that subsection right there removes it all. It cripples it, because it means you have to make an allowance for that exception. And the only way to make an allowance for that exception is either to do something like Ray Ozzie suggested, or again, to make that back door. And they'd probably say, we'll just make the back door and we're really only going to use it when we're authorized under subsection C, which we just discussed, means there's no encryption at all.
Yeah, it almost sounds like they added that section into the bill so that it would pass. So like they, right. Even though it doesn't really do anything, they added it in there so that people say, oh, okay, there seems like there's a workaround. So this is good. This is good for us.
Right. It's like saying, well, you know, this won't happen unless we count to infinity. And then the subsection C says, unless we do count to infinity. It's like, well, that's never going to happen. I mean, if they've done their job in the first place and they didn't allow a law enforcement agency to come in and weaken the encryption, then they're not going to be able to get back in. If the user has the only key and you've made a really strong encryption algorithm, then what's the manufacturer supposed to do? What's that court order supposed to do? Well, it can't do anything unless you have already done the things you said you weren't going to do.
Right.
So, yay.
So, Kurt, what does this do for third parties? Like we talked about, like there's a gray shift. There's some other companies out there that are, you know, coming out with solutions that essentially walk through all the security measures and they're able to decrypt and do this. Do you think that this, by doing this law, let's say it goes into law, and and manufacturers are forced to do this, will we find that there's going to be more and more third parties that are going to be pushing their solutions to kind of walk around encryption or get through it? Rather than actually having this way law enforcement will go to them and ask for that data rather than them having to do it themselves?
I think that that's going to happen regardless of what happens to this bill. We've seen that there is a market opportunity for tools that will get into encrypted devices. And I think that since we've seen that there is a market, we'll see more and more companies coming out that have tools that are similar. And it's going to be fascinating because, like most of technology, what we'll start to see is a two-factor race, one towards greater features and one towards lower price. So I think within 24 months, pretty much every police department that has more than, two officers will have one of these tools. And the big departments, the big agencies, we'll have the really good ones.
Right. So this is also an interesting aspect. So we talked a little bit about how FBI has already kind of been using these third parties to get through things. They maybe even have their own system internally because of the whole Apple debacle months ago when they asked for Apple to unlock somebody's phone and they wouldn't do it. So they found their alternate solution. I guess, Padre, is this something that maybe the government agencies will weigh in here where they'll be asking for maybe some other law or maybe some other way to basically decrypt it because now they're going to be stuck between a rock and a hard place without having that? Even that stipulation in the bill, they're not going to get by. So, like, is there something that they're going to be weighing in here? Is there something they need?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even if this does pass, and it is still kind of a long shot that it's going to pass, if it does pass, that discrepancy between subsection B and subsection C is something that the FBI lawyers are going to have a field day with because they're going to say, well, we need to make sure you can comply with subsection C before you implement subsection B. But doing that means you're not actually implementing subsection B. So that's the kind of logic that we're going to see. If this does pass, expect to see a lot of suits asking for clarification and a lot of suits that are just going to assume that it meant that, yes, this bill actually says we can put a backdoor. That's part of the game. But you know what? It's worth it, and it's worth to stay on top of the story so you understand who's pushing for what, who actually understands encryption, who actually understands security, and who actually understands best practices.
Right. It sounds like the government's more and more is attempting to bring in people who actually understand this stuff. So hopefully this, we'll see more and more of that, and we'll see a little bit more legislation actually make sense for the industry and it potentially moves us forward. But we'll have to see. I think we'll have to see what's going on with the legislation if they get there where we need to be. Well, let's move on to the next bite because I think the next bite is pretty interesting as well. We have a little bit about Google and their new system called Duplex. So what if you were having a conversation with someone over the phone or voice chat, and instead of it being human on the other line, it was actually a computer, indistinguishable from a human? Would you feel tricked? Would you feel violated? Would you think that they should have disclosed themselves as if they were not human in the beginning of the conversation? Would you think, man, how can I get a hold of that tool? Well, during Google I/O this past week, Google debuted Google Duplex, It's a proof of concept that uses natural language understanding, deep learning, text-to-speech fluency, and other technologies to perform the tedious tasks for people of setting up appointments. We do have a quick clip here to show how it does. It's actually kind of scary.
Hello, how can I help you?
Hi, I'm calling to book a women's haircut for a client. I'm looking for something on May 3rd.
Sure, give me 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
That's Google, by the way.
Sure, what time are you looking for around?
At 12 p.m.
We do not have a 12 p.m. available. The closest we have to that is a 1:15.
Do you have anything between 10 a.m. and 12 p.m.?
Depending on what service she would like, what service is she looking for?
Just a woman's haircut for now.
Okay, we have a 10 o'clock.
So we could cut it off there. I think the interesting part here, though, is it's just kind of scary because they understand the nuances of the conversation, and then they kind of wade through the idiosyncrasies of the different dialects here, and plus they have the ability to kind of go in different directions based off the conversation. And if you listen, Duplex even throws in there a couple filler words like and ah, which are normally ways for people that, you know, when they're trying to decide something to say. So that latency in between there, that delay, definitely makes it sound even more human. It's essentially like a psychological trick that humans think, hey, the computers would never do that. So the system even uses tricks to distinguish when AI doesn't understand. It can bring the conversation back on track. It can also navigate a series of misunderstandings by rephrasing the question or repeating it. It even uses verbal tricks such as including elaborations like, hey, for Friday next week, the 18th, or syncs like, can you hear me? Or interruptions like, the number is 212. Oh, sorry. Can you start over? If the call goes entirely wrong, a human can actually take over like an operator. So there are several interesting nuances to the system that can actually be improved. And in fact, what I noticed is if the system detects what the system could do instead of kind of going through the nuances of the different dialects, if the system detected that it wasn't the English wasn't the first dialect or the first language that the person or their native language that they speak, that it could make it easier by maybe speaking in that person's native language, or maybe asking them that this way it makes it easier not to have to kind of navigate through all the different nuances of a conversation. Also, professionalism. Now, the way that they've actually devised the system is that they attempt to mimic human faults, like it makes it seem almost unconfident in its dialect. So to me, that kind of turns off the system. It turns me off on the system, because if you were to essentially leave a conversation with somebody and say, thinking, wow, that person was clear and concise and confident what they're saying and they're very commanding, it would seem like a much better service. But in this case, it seemed kind of uneasy, unsure what they're doing. It's very interesting that they're kind of taking that approach and moving forward. But it does set up a couple questions here. So throw it over to you, Padre. It sounds like almost an ethical issue. Like, for instance, this is mimicking how humans are actually behaving, and the person on the other line has no idea that it's actually a computer. Is this something that we're going to have fixed in the future? Are we going to have to make some kind of law that says, hey, you have to make sure you say this before you start the conversation, like, hey, you're being recorded, or hey, I'm not human, rather than actually kind of jumping right in?
I don't think there's any need to be a law, but I think there definitely needs to be customers expressing their preferences. Like, for example, I don't think any voice assistant like a Duplex or whatever Microsoft is coming up with on their side or Amazon should have a conversation with a human without first informing the human that this is an automated conversation, because that's a huge potential for some mix-ups. It's just rude. In the world of AI, that's considered rude not to inform someone that they're speaking to an AI. And especially since the Duplex goes through the trouble of mimicking human speech patterns, of delaying and drawing out and saying So obviously they're trying to do something. If this was an actual physical presence, this would be so firmly in the uncanny valley that people would just kind of reel back in revulsion. And we all know that when you see something that's almost lifelike, but just not completely lifelike, it just feels off. It's the same thing with this. It's almost like lifelike, but just not there. And I think you can avoid a lot of those issues if you just tell people, look, this is an automated assistant. If you would prefer to speak to a real person, please press 1.
Right. So, Curtis, what about this? What about the next? Do we think that this is going to have some security implications? Could this be the culmination of the next generation of spam callers?
I will say that it gets even more fascinating. Let's walk down this particular paranoid fantasy walk. We know that we've seen proof of concept of attackers being able to do things like play a snippet of music or play what sounds like an innocuous text string and embedded within it at a level that humans can't hear, really, are the commands to trigger one of the voice assistants. So we know that's possible. Now, what if instead of a human being having to make that call, what if instead of having to do this via a standard phishing campaign where you've got to get someone to click on a link or open an attachment, you just call them. And you had your robotic voice assistant placing millions of these calls just to see which ones would hit. All of a sudden, in the same way that email lost a lot of its value after spam became such a high percentage of all email messages, we could easily see a situation where voice assistants or voice messaging loses a lot of its effectiveness and efficiency because of just an overwhelming number of spam calls.
Makes sense. Well, folks, we've run out of time for the bites, but you know, next week we definitely have to get back in and talk a little bit about AI and how things are going on. But this brings us to my favorite part of the show, where we get to bring in a guest who gets to drop some knowledge on the Private Wyatt, on the Twilight Riot. And today we have Sanjay Upal, VP and GM of the VeloCloud business unit at VMware. Sanjay, thank you so much for being here on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Not at all. I'm very glad to be here.
So VeloCloud was recently acquired by VMware. Well, not recently, I guess last year, but it was recently acquired. And I think that you know, what might be good is to give us our viewers and our listeners a little bit of a recap of essentially what SD-WAN is and what kind of problems it solves.
Sure, absolutely. So VeloCloud got acquired by VMware 5 months ago. In fact, tomorrow it is going to be exactly 5 months. And what VeloCloud was doing and is doing right now is going after what's known as the SD-WAN space. And so that's software-defined wide area networking. And because the entire world is moving to software, you know, we felt, well, why not the networking part of it as well? And just like Amazon and Salesforce and Dropbox and Box and all these IT companies have moved a lot of the technology that otherwise existed on the premises of a business or an enterprise, they moved those to the cloud and are running it as a service. We felt that the same should be done for wide area networking, which means, you know, the routing, firewalling, VPN, secure web gateway, WAN optimization, all of this that currently exists on pretty heavy gear that sits on all the corners of an enterprise. It's pretty difficult to install and run and keep maintained and all of that. So we felt that if you move that into the cloud and run it as a service, enterprises will be attracted to it in droves and will adopt it because all the benefits of the cloud would accrue to networking as well.
Makes sense. So SD-WAN sounds like it's essentially an overlay over SDN or software-defined network principles. How do you think VeloCloud kind of adds to those principles? Does it alter them? Does it create a hybrid version of them? Like how does it kind of overlay over top of them?
Yeah, so SD-WAN, you know, when we started this thing, we didn't call it SD-WAN, but the whole world was becoming software-defined and some of the, you know, brighter people in the space said, hey, look, that's software-defined. And we said, fine, we'll go along with that. But it does apply SDN principles, not specifically the SDN code itself, meaning that we don't use, you know, OpenFlow and all those protocols. But there is a separation between the management plane and the control plane. And there's a separation between the control plane and the data plane. And so in that, SD-WAN does adhere to the SDN principles. But you can think of SD-WAN as being two things. One is it's very simply an overlay. So overlay meaning that the networking technology itself, whether you're connected in with a broadband cable or whether you're connected in with DSL or whether you have a private line or you might be connected in with LTE, you know, all of those to us, we call them underlay technologies, right? Those are the transport links. And before SD-WAN came along, you had to worry about what's the characteristics of that transport link. How good is your cable for supporting your voice traffic, or how good is your private line for supporting video? And so you had to worry about that and things like bit error rates and, you know, response times and things of that sort. Well, what the overlay does is it hides the complexity of all these individual transports from you, but it accommodates for any deficiencies in the underlay by providing all of the technology to fix them in the overlay. So as an example, a business can say, you know, I have 500 branch office locations, I'm selling fashion, and I really want to make sure that when people call in, the voice always works, regardless of what the underlay is, regardless of whether it's private or public or LTE. Just make sure that other things may fail, but the voice should always work. So then we go to work, so to speak, and then the overlay takes care of any deficiencies in the broadband at that moment of time and will steer the traffic in the right direction so that the voice will work. So that's that separation between underlay and overlay, you know, has adherence to SDN principles in the large. But of course, we do separate the control plane from the data plane and the management plane as well.
Makes sense. So essentially, you have an overlay network with encryption. You have some internet service or internet protocol service level agreements, and then you have some policies to kind of route and steer traffic. Did I get that about right?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, we distinguish routing from steering, because routing gets something from point A to point B. Steering traffic, you might have several ways of getting to point A from point A to point B. And what the steering does, it chooses the best path for that instant of time, meaning that, you know, to go from point A to point B, you might go, you know, on one path for one packet, but you might take another path for the next packet. And you just do that on the basis of what is the business policy? What are you trying to achieve? You're trying to achieve better performance, better security. You're trying to control your costs. So you put all of those together, and then we do this application steering on the top of a routed and a switched network.
Makes sense. So now that we've kind of established SD-WAN, how does VeloCloud kind of, how is it a differentiator? How does it add to this kind of the SD-WAN concept? What kind of services does it bring that makes it unique?
Yeah. So, you know, there's three things that make VeloCloud unique. So the first thing is that, you know, what used to happen before is you had all this infrastructure sitting on all the edges of an enterprise, right? And then what we did uniquely is to take a lot of those services, move it into the cloud and run those as a service. So what used to be physical and a product became virtual and a service. And that shift VeloCloud has done differently than anyone else. Most of the other SD-WAN players have continued to simplify gear that's sitting out there on the premises of an enterprise. So we have a functioning cloud service today. It's in 30 locations around the world. 500 gateways are running, and we use that to provide SD-WAN as a service. So that's one of the distinguishing features. The gear that goes into the cloud, we call it a VeloCloud Gateway, and it's multi-tenanted. It sits close to where the cloud applications are, and it can be horizontally scalable, and it does a lot of the magic in terms of what I was saying, the application steering. Now, the application steering itself, what is different about the way that VeloCloud does it is that we do it on a per packet basis. So on every packet, we make an independent decision. Should we send the packet on, you know, the first link or the second link or the third link, you know, provided there are three links, or should we hold it back, or should we duplicate it on one more or more links, or should we not send it out at all? And that decision is a very important decision, because along with that decision, you also decide what is the next service that that packet should get. So it may be that this is really important PCI traffic coming from your store, and you want to send it back to your data center so that it should be scrubbed. Or there could be somebody sitting in your store who's browsing Netflix. Well, why do you really care that much about it? And you just want to drop it out on the internet. So those kinds of decisions we do on a per packet basis. Most companies do them on a per flow basis. With the per packet, you can support real-time applications very well. So voice, video, VDI, IoT, these are all real-time apps, which, as you know, are pretty difficult to run just on the vanilla internet. But if you make a per packet steering technology and make it scale, then that's a differentiator. And then the last one is we spend a lot of time in making these things really, really simple. So, you know, it's gear in Silicon Valley. People say designed in California, built in China. I used to say our VeloCloud SD-WAN is designed for Lisa, built in China. And Lisa used to be my office administrator, and she's not there anymore. She's now gone off and done, better things in her career. But she was completely non-technical, and, she was the guinea pig. She could take it out of the box and connect the cables and go to her email, click a URL, and she had a whole branch office up and running in the matter of a few minutes. And so that, to me, is a distinguishing feature, because we want to make this networking technology really simple. I mean, why should somebody, an ordinary person, need to know what is 192.168.1.1? They shouldn't. And they should just want to know. Hey, they want to connect to the network. These apps should work. And if there's some congestion, then these apps are more important than these other apps.
Right. So the interesting question is, like, I think that there are some organizations that might want to customize the system. They want to add kind of that you get those power users, these power IT developers that want to kind of get there and customize the system. Is this more like are you providing a platform for like the third party ecosystem to build on top of it? Or is it just kind of, the software is what it is?
No, you get both. So, for the folks who want the utmost in simplicity and they don't want to touch anything and, they want to configure it all from the GUI and everything, then it is really simple. You can get it up and running. You can get your entire network up and running in the matter of a few days. However, as you pointed out, it's also a platform, because anything that goes into the enterprise needs to not just fit into what's already available, but it also needs to be extensible. So as an example, let's say that we have a firewall that sits on each one of our devices at the endpoints, but some companies have already selected a firewall, or they want, a more enterprise scalable firewall. Then the SD-WAN that we provide is a platform, because anything that you do inside VeloCloud, the service, you can drive that through an API. So you can, while everything's nicely very well packaged and it's simple, if you really want to get into the nitty-gritty, you can control everything using these APIs. And so you can stick other VNFs, they're called virtual network functions, alongside with VeloCloud, and you can chain them together, and then you can get a much more extensible system. An example of this is security. Another example of this would be, as you were just discussing this whole area of artificial intelligence, that we gather an enormous amount of data, how networks are working, who's using what applications are running. And if you take out the privacy angle of it and you anonymize everything, you can redirect how the network is working, almost in real time. Like there's faults happening here. How do you redirect the traffic? You steer it in this other direction. And all of that can happen because SD-WAN with VeloCloud and VMware is also a platform.
Fantastic. Well, I could probably ask you a million more questions, but I see that in the chat here that my co-hosts are also asking to ask something. So Padre, I wanted to go ahead and throw it over to you to ask something.
Yes, Sanjay, it's interesting because maybe 14, 15 years ago, any discussion of WAN would just be, okay, so I've got a connection to the internet. Maybe I have a point-to-point to another one of my offices. Perhaps I have a discussion about a VERP. But SD-WAN has really sort of changed the game, because it's no longer a delineation of my network from the outside network. I am now putting services into the cloud. I'm putting my infrastructure into the cloud. How much of your work is convincing those old customers with that old understanding of what a WAN and a WAN service is, and just trying to teach them the efficiencies that they can gain by moving certain parts of their infrastructure into, say, the VMware cloud?
Yeah. So that's a great question. And I think I'll answer it giving an example. I was, 3 years ago, I was sitting in front of the CIO of a Fortune 500 company, and we were going through, what does this mean? What does it mean to take networking to the cloud? People had not heard of it. Now, of course, it's a lot more prevalent. And we're going through this architectural discussion, and the CIO seemed to be getting more convinced. And then we were talking about a pretty large-sized company, and then the CEO walks in, and everybody turns around and looks at the CEO. And, he was saying, where does this magic come from? What does networking in the cloud mean? And so, I was going through this explanation. And after the meeting got over, people all looked at each other kind of a little in wonderment, saying, the CEO of this company has never, ever walked into a meeting that concerned networking at all. So this was like a first. And the reason for this is because it is a pretty dramatic shift. And yes, it did require, I'd say a few years ago, you know, convincing people that this old hub and spoke model and everything going through, you know, these private lines back to where the applications were, that technology and that architecture is going through a disruption and a massive shift. And now it's moving to the cloud. But what we are helped by with is that, you know, there is this trend of things moving to the cloud. So 3 years ago and 4 years ago, it was more difficult. Now it's a more straightforward explanation because people just follow the line of thinking that if they've already moved some applications to the cloud, if they've already moved some of their storage to the cloud, then it really makes sense and they get it that they need to move some of their networking to the cloud and then they can buy things on a pay-as-you-go basis. It's a service. They can give it to the experts to run. Like we change the back-end software on our gateways a lot more often than people would change the software that's running on their custom proprietary, high-end box-based routers. And we do that so often because there's a lot of value in it. And then the end customer doesn't have to touch 1,000 locations to change their software. So yeah, it used to be more difficult, but now it's become much more straightforward to describe this change and why people should adopt it.
Yeah, and it's straightforward because, well, our audience understands it. We've been covering it for 7 years now, and they've seen the gradual change to a cloud-based infrastructure. But it is I'd say, curious to see every once in a while someone who is stuck in the old, I control everything in my LAN and everything in the WAN is an external network, because they still do exist, They still do occasionally need to be convinced that, no, it's okay to take some of your stuff and put it upstream. And this is the cost savings, and this is what it's going to do to your future expenditures. Easy sell once someone gets it, but yeah, sometimes people need a little help getting it. The follow-up question to that would be, what do you see as next? Because, I mean, we're already at the point where I have no trouble putting my authentication servers into the cloud. I have no trouble with putting all my storage into the cloud. I have no trouble with basically taking everything that used to be in my campus data center and making it external. Well, when everything becomes external, is it really still SD-WAN or is it just SD network?
Well, you know, what I usually say is that in a few years' time, people are not going to say SD-WAN. They're just going to say WAN because that's going to be the architecture of the WAN going forward. But what's next is, if you look at the other end of the connection, so you talked about, you know, all these things moving to the cloud and you're comfortable in doing them. But what about the other end? By other end, I mean, what about the ends of the enterprise? It's branch offices today and there's people who are sitting in these branch offices. And, you know, branch office to us is extremely varied. We just installed a couple of VeloCloud devices on an oil ship. And so the oil ship becomes a branch office. So it could be a construction trailer. It is all kinds of branch offices. But when you look at these places where work is done, it's no longer just the human being that's doing the work. There's also a lot of these, you know, call it Internet of Things, call it devices, what have you. And so we see in retail locations, there may be 3 to 5 human users at that retail location. But there may be 500 sensors and things and devices in the retail location. So when you look at how this Internet of Things and intersects with SD-WAN, you know, that's one area that is really going to take off in the next several years, because there's no need, in our opinion, to set up a yet another network for your IoT. You can just take IoT as yet another data type. You define certain policies for it. You steer the traffic based on those policies, and it can run on the same network that you have, the same enterprise network that you have right now. So that's one area that I clearly see that there's going to be a lot of work. The other area is all the integration that we're doing with the VMware stack. So VMware, of course, is very strong in the data center, in the movement of workloads from private data centers to the public cloud. And so VeloCloud's integration in with NSX data center and NSX cloud is something that I think is going to really help businesses like financial businesses, retail businesses, because now they can use the same physical network, all these underlays that we talked about, but it can look very different depending on the type of traffic. So if you're a retail company, You can use the same underlay, and using SD-WAN, you can have 5 networks. It can be a network for your guests for Wi-Fi. It can be a network for your PCI traffic. It can be one network for your inventory, another network for your merchandising, and a 5th network for all your IoT devices. So it can literally be the same physical network can be 5 virtual networks. And that's the power of virtualization brought into the networking space, which we at VMware are calling the virtual cloud network, which, you know, of course, SD-WAN is one part of that.
Right.
Sanjay, I've got a question. When you talk about SD-WAN being part of that cloud network, it seems to me that really one of the chief parts of this are all of those APIs that you talked about a while ago. I'm curious, with your existing customers, how many of them are really embracing that and making the SD-WAN part of their dynamic application chain? I mean, that's part of the promise of SD-WAN, that it can adapt on a rules basis to changes in server count and server deployment, in traffic loads, in dynamic load balancing, all of these things. But all that's based upon using those APIs to do it on a machine basis. Is that something that's already happening to a great extent, or is that part of the future promise of SD-WAN?
Yeah, good question, Curtis. So, you know, it's happening, I would say, in the small right now, meaning that there's certain places where you can scale easily and you can add functionality and move this along. So when you think of networking as the ecosystem, so you have traffic coming in from your branch offices, which could be sensor traffic or things traffic. It goes through an edge device, and then that traffic ends up in the cloud. Now that cloud, how the traffic is steered through the cloud, which gateway it hits, how many gateways does it hit, how to scale the gateways up and down, and where is the egress point onto the cloud, all of that is pretty dynamic today. We can do all of that in real time, sub-second failover and the like. Now, what is not so dynamic right now is once it egresses the SD-WAN ecosystem and it goes into where the workloads are, then that is not fully automated today. Like, you know, if you send a deluge of traffic through one egress point, it's not that you can spin up all the workloads automatically. That is more, will be more futuristic, will be more intelligence based. It will use the APIs that we talked about, but does require some integration. So, you know, some parts are already there, and that's the promise, and that's why SD-WAN has taken off the way that it has. I mean, it's just skyrocketed, in the last few years or so, that every enterprise now is looking at this. But the promise of everything from the one endpoint, which could be a sensor, all the way to the workload itself, that entire chain is not that dynamic yet. It's the middle parts, the networking, that is more dynamic. The endpoints still have to become dynamic.
Fantastic. Well, unfortunately, we've actually run out of time. And folks, you've done it again. You've wasted another hour of the best darn enterprise tech show, according to 9 out of 10 terminating nodes. I first also want to thank our guest, Sanjay Upal, the CEO and founder of VeloCloud, but now, of course, the VP and the GM of VeloCloud Division and VMware. Thank you so much for joining us on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Not at all. You're most welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
Fantastic. Can you just maybe tell the audience at home where they can find you and your work and anything about VeloCloud?
Yeah, sure. You can go to www.velocloud.com. You can also go to www.vmware.com and then look for SD-WAN or VeloCloud. I'm also at iNetNut, and you can find me on LinkedIn.
Of course, folks, I also want to thank my co-hosts in crime. They make the show fun. They make it worthwhile. Starting, of course, with our very own Padre SJ. Padre, I think you being here, you obviously used to be the host. You are the host. You will always be the host. Can you tell the folks at home what you're doing now and what you're going to be doing?
Well, I'll be retiring, and they're going to put me out at a small red farmhouse in the middle of Nebraska, as we often do. No, but seriously, I'm not going away. I'm just going someplace else for a while. I'm still doing a know-how here on the Twit TV network. You'll find me on Twit till it's my time to leave. And don't be surprised if I find my way back occasionally once I get to Rome. But if you want to find out everything that I'm doing, don't forget to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/PadreSJ.
Fantastic. Thanks, Padre. Well, I definitely want to thank the ominous Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
Well, as always, you can find my writings at Dark Reading. If you want to know when I've done something new, please follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. Enjoying staying put for a short while. We've got a virtual event coming up shortly. I'm going to be going to some various events here in the Orlando area, getting ready out in the first week of August for Black Hat, and then looking way ahead to Dark Reading's own event in security coming up in October in Chicago. So lots of fun, lots of goodness. Please follow me on Twitter to keep up with every single bit of it.
Thank you, Curtis. Thanks, guys, for being here. I also want to thank everyone who makes the show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa, who supports us to continue to do This Week in Enterprise Tech week after week. Thank you to all the engineers. And also, of course, thank you to Brian Shee, our tireless producer. If you have show ideas, of course, hit him up on Twitter at ADVNetLab. He is also always looking for new and interesting enterprise guests. So hit him up there if you have some ideas. Of course, folks, we couldn't do this show without you. And we want to thank you, and we want to make it easy for you to tune in each and every week. Without you, we couldn't do this show. So go ahead and make, in order to make it easier for you to watch and listen, go over to the show page right now, twit.tv/Twiat. You can find all of our back episodes, all of the show notes, the guest information, links to our shows, to the different stories we actually did during the shows. And more importantly, next to the videos there, there's that magic button that allows you to subscribe to a format of your choice, whether it's audio, video, HD video, and to the device of your choice, whether it's a phone, tablet, laptop, or desktop. Also, remember, we do this show live each and every week at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time at live.twit.tv. And of course, if you're going to join us live, you might as well jump into our chat room as well, which is irc.twit.tv. The show definitely becomes very rich, and we get a lot more content when we have the chat room there. So we want to thank them for being there and making this show better. Also, don't forget to follow me at twitter.com/LouMM, where you can find all the cool things that I'm working on. And of course, you could always visit the work that I do in my daily job here. You check it out at dev.microsoft.com and dev.office.com. That's all the work that I do on the office team here. Of course, I want to thank our TD, Kevin, for today. Kevin, you have a camera on yourself. Are you keeping yourself busy there in the black hole of the studio?
Yeah, the black hole featuring a padre.
We can't do without a black hole and a padre. So thank you to you, and we hope to see you again next week. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca saying, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.